of the morning, appeal number 08-1881, Bozzie Miller, PC versus the estate of Gaylord. Now, there's a kind of unusual procedural twist in this case, and I know there's a pending motion to intervene by the trustee. And is Mr. McClintock here?
Mr. Goldstein, Your Honor, counsel for the creditor trustee appointed into bankruptcy.
Okay, I think that I'll try to make some sense out of this. Maybe I could just hear briefly from the intervener on our motions order was that it would be taken with the case, and just to proceed just a little bit of order here, maybe you could say for a minute or two why you believe intervention is appropriate here, and maybe tell me why you didn't intervene in the district court.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent the creditor trustee that was appointed to administer the liquidating trust within the bankruptcy. Your Honor, we did seek to intervene earlier on in the case. This is a trust that has been almost completely administered. The trust went effective on October 4th of 2005, so the trust has been administered for over 3.5 years. The trust's purpose is to administer a number of assets and
cause. What happened in the district court on intervention, if anything?
I don't recall whether it was in bankruptcy court or in district court. I think it was in district court. The district court declined to dismiss based on our motion. I think.
But did the district court grant intervention? I don't believe it did.
I don't believe it did, Your Honor. I'm not sure that's relevant, and I know that the appellant addresses that and argues that that issue isn't before the court. However, Your Honor, that goes to the court's jurisdiction. What we're asserting is equitable mootness, Your Honor. And as Your Honor knows, subject matter jurisdiction can be raised any time. There's also cases regarding equitable mootness, which I know isn't exactly subject matter jurisdiction, but it's a very similar concept. And because as the case progresses, more things occur, that can be raised at any time, because while it may not have been equitably moot before, it may be equitably moot now. There's been a lot of activity since the original motion to intervene to file a motion to dismiss on equitable mootness grounds was presented.
Okay. Well, we do have your brief, and we have a response to the brief from Mr. Miller. So we will decide that as part of our ultimate decision in this case, and we will be obviously taking the arguments in this case under advisement and issuing a written decision which will include or encompass the intervention issues. So with that, let's go to the merits of this case.
Here for your indulgence, Your Honor.
Mr. Miller.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. I'm Marshall Lee Miller for Bays and Miller. This case has been styled as one in bankruptcy, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with bankruptcy. Bays and Miller is not one of the seven debtors in the Ingersoll estate. It's not one of the 1,200 creditors in the Ingersoll case. In the years of discussions and negotiations involving the bankruptcy, the record shows that not once was Bays and Miller's name ever brought up. That's not just our opinion, that's the opinion of the Gaylords in the district court litigation in D.C. Over months of hearings, negotiations, depositions, and motions to dismiss, not once was any reference made by the Gaylords or their attorneys to the existence of a bankruptcy action out here in Illinois.
It does seem, if anything is clear in the somewhat murky record in this case, it seems fairly certain that the Gaylords were very interested in capping attorney's fees in this case and not letting the bill run up to a very high number, and a couple of rejections were on an attorney-client relationship were in the record until this contract that capped fees at $250,000.
Well, let me make it clear, Your Honor, when I talk about what the case is not about, let me tell you what the case is about. It's not a fee dispute. There are no legal fees in dispute. There's no bankruptcy action in dispute. We have no desire to unravel the bankruptcy action. In fact, the situation is so extreme that if use this as disinterest, if a meteor from outer space were to hit the Ingersoll factory and wipe out all of its assets, apart from the humanitarian concerns, of course, we would have no interest. In other words, this is the matter. What makes a case murky is continuing to bring up issues that have been resolved many years ago. Here's what's at issue here. The Gaylords made an agreement with the D.C. Bar Association and with us, and they compelled it. We couldn't compel it. It doesn't work both ways. To take this matter to arbitration back in 2004. This is on the fees and the cap and all that's involved. That matter went through several months of arbitration before a free panel, which included a practicing lawyer, an economist, and a law professor, as I recall. That ended up giving Bays and Miller 100% of all that we'd asked for. After some more delay, that was paid. Matter over. There is no fee dispute. Where the dispute came, this is in part of the arbitration agreement that the Gaylord signed when they compelled arbitration. They agreed that this would be binding and exclusive arbitration. Well, after several months, they went off to Delaware and raised the very same issues that had been litigated here before, and apparently they're trying to litigate again in this court, that had already been resolved. Now, as you would expect, the district court up there ruled that it's res judicata, dismissed the actions, and that was it. But Bays and Miller had incurred several thousand dollars in costs, quite a number of thousand dollars in costs, as a result of their breach of their arbitration agreement with the D.C. Bar Association. This is what the action that we brought in D.C. So you can see, we didn't even know about, or care about, or have any interest in anything relating to Ingersoll. It had to do with actions the Gaylords took, not at the behest of the trustee or anybody else, but on their own, to disregard their sworn promises and bring us another action challenging what they challenged before. Does that answer your question on this? Now, this should be simple for another reason. Since we're not a creditor, debtor, party in interest in this thing, there has never been a case in the United States in 220 years of bankruptcy being a federal matter, I think it's 220, that a non-creditor, non-debtor, non-party in interest should be barred from bringing actions against someone who was involved in one of those suits for something separate. And you can certainly understand why. It's been tried a few times. But if this were to happen, anyone who is involved in any way in a bankruptcy action with a little bit of hometown advantage could get someone to say, you don't have to pay your mortgage, you don't have to pay your car bills, you don't have to pay your vendors, you don't have to pay your creditors, you don't have to pay anything else. Now, everyone decided, the judge decided, Barbosa decided, the bankruptcy judge decided, that what was really at issue here was the release. Now, as I said, we had nothing to do with the release. That was all negotiated beyond our knowledge. But here's what the release says, and here's what it was limited to. Excuse me just a second. And moving back and forth between counsel, I lose this. And this is given on page 13 of our brief, in case you want to follow along with me. Here's what the release is limited to, and see if it applies to Bays and Miller. All creditors, we already had ruling we're not a creditor, parties in interest, nobody's even raised that, directors, officers, shareholders, agents, affiliates, parents, I'll go on and on, but none of these are relevant to us, and representatives of debtors and their estates, and that's clearly not us. That's what the release is limited to. Now, it goes on to say, if you get past that hurdle, which does not include us, that this is arising from or related to the Gaylord actions. Now, these are not undefined. They're specifically given as two cases, neither of which is us. And even then, it's not a Cole Porter would have said, anything goes. It's limited only in those matters to by any present or former party to any of the Gaylord actions. In other words, this release, which is the Gaylords agreed to, which is part of the settlement, which we're not trying to unravel, specifically excludes Bays and Miller and its claims in D.C. for breach of contract. And that's our argument, Judge.
Okay. Ms. Gaylord? Brian?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kimberly Gaylord, my sister Lori Gaylord behind me, on behalf of my family, Lori, Lisa, and Kimberly Gaylord, and my dear father, Robert Gaylord, who is deceased. My apologies in advance for my nervousness and not knowing the proper etiquette of the Court. I'm recovering from a very serious illness. And
you're doing fine, don't worry about it.
Pro se, and I'm nervous, so forgive me. My parents always tell me to look for the good in the difficult lessons in life, and today you all are the good. It is a great honor to stand before such esteemed legal scholars.
Judge Bauer is the only real esteemed.
Mr. Miller was engaged by our family back in the very end of November of 2000 in order to stop the sale of the crown jewel of our family's company, which was founded in 1887 and was the largest privately held manufacturing machine tool company in the world. We were considered and are still the Rolls-Royce of the machine tool industry, and it has been in our family ever since and run by our family ever since, till my uncle died in April of 2000. And a new CEO and a new chairman of the board took over, and a chauffeur that was bringing them to and from Chicago informed me that he overheard conversations that they were going to take down the company. We immediately sought counsel, Mr. Miller. We spoke with him, and we thought he was our angel. We had a deadline of December 1st for the first sale, which was the domestic division. The German division was to be sold on the 5th of the coming year. Now, mind you, these are the cutting tool companies, which represent 92 to 95% of the net operating profit for Ingersoll International, the parent company. So anyone could understand the magnitude of selling off the crown jewels financially. So we sought counsel, and I tell you two things. Number one, I don't blame you if you don't believe this story, because had we not lived it for the past decade, I wouldn't believe it either. And number two, I'm going to use strong words, professional but strong words, when referring to Mr. Miller, because
we have read your brief, and it is chock full of strong words.
What happened was Mr. Miller is a fraud. When we spoke with him, he asked for a $100,000 retainer, and he promised us that he had judges in Delaware that owed him favors, that he would go to their home and, quote-unquote, call in a favor and see to it that the December 1st sale was stopped. He told us that he had a partner of many years at Skadden Arps that he worked with, and he told us that he was an expert in corporate litigation and that he had a full team available for the quote-unquote data dump that we would be getting from Ingersoll. As it turns out, he is an environmental lawyer. He had one individual working with him who was fresh out of law school, and this was his first case. He did not have a long-standing relationship with someone at Skadden Arps, and the gentleman that he picked was met him for the first time at our house when they were getting ready to prepare the documents to submit to Judge Strine in Delaware for a temporary restraining order. They did not get it together in time. The temporary restraining order, we did not get it. However, the Leo Strine said that we had a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits for the DNO litigation that would ensue thereafter. But the first part of the sale went through. The horse was out of the barn. And by the time we came back on the 5th, the Leo Strine's, Judge Strine, said, horse is out of the barn. What do you want me to do? Sale's going to go through. The sale did go through, and when you lose 92% to 95% of your net profit, it's not long before your company goes bankrupt. And this 127-year-old company that is really an American icon went bankrupt. In the meantime, while Mr. Miller was at our house, my father is old school. He did multi-million dollar...
Remind you that these lights tell you that you're running out of time, so...
My father did multi-million dollar deals on a handshake. His word was as good as a contract. Better, in this instance, certainly. And Mr. Miller, we had an oral cafe agreement for $250,000 for 3.5 weeks' worth of work, which I think is a fair compensation. And Mr. Miller submitted 2 written encapsulations of that to us, which were, had nothing to do with the cafe and had a excess bonus. We refused to sign. He then told us it wasn't necessary to have written documentation. My father's word is good. We went off. We fully performed on the contract. They got their $250,000. And a month later, we got a bill for $390,000 from Marshall Miller. And what had happened, reading between the lines, is Mr. Miller subcontracted with an individual in Delaware for local counsel, and they got into a dispute because Mr. Miller wasn't paying
Mr. Was that
Marcus.
The fellow who was with Skadden Arps?
He had been with Skadden Arps, but was now in his own boutique firm. So he wasn't getting any money from Mr. Miller. The two of them decided that it was easier to go after an 80-year-old ailing man with deep pockets. We got sued in double jurisdictions. We argued to the court vehemently exactly what he was talking about, that these are the same set of facts. This is an issue arising out of the same set of facts and circumstances, and they should be combined. But clearly their goal was to make this as expensive and as difficult as possible for us. So we defended in 2 venues. We did go before the D.C. arbitration. Contrary to how Mr. Miller describes it, the D.C. arbitration board refused to state anything on whether there was a capped fee agreement. They did, however, say that we owe Bays and Miller $199,000, roughly. We'd already paid them $250,000. So there was roughly $51,000 sitting there somewhere in la-la land. They asked for another explanation. Then the D.C. Arbitration Board came back and reiterated, we have no intention of commenting on the cap fee. We have no intention of commenting on what Miller owes Margulies, but $199 is the amount that they are supposed to pay, and since we'd already paid the $250, logic says we owe them no money at that point. However, somehow they managed to take it to the Washington District Court, and the District Court came up with a number of $83,000 that we owed them, that to this day I do not understand how they managed that. But that is in the supporting material. If perhaps you could figure it out. We never were able to figure that out. Our we're law-abiding citizens. They said you have to pay it. We paid it. And the next thing you know, we are out in Delaware, and interestingly, the only trier of fact that ever heard this case, Judge Scott out in Delaware, found in our favor. And he said, yes, there was a cap fee for $250,000 for 3.5 weeks' worth of work. Yes, your father did say, I'm not paying you one penny more. And, you know, the Gaylords owe Margulies nothing. And if Margulies needs money, he needs to go to Miller, who he subcontracted with. That was the ruling there, and that was the only trier fact that ever heard our case that he found in our favor, but we're still out the $83,000, and we thought that we had been, our life was rid of this. I mean, bad enough that he's lost our company and it's bankrupt and thousands of people are out of jobs and our heritage is gone. I mean, it's and an American icon, particularly in this day and age, going down like that is horrible. And then all of a sudden, Mr. Miller shows up at the Delaware litigation. Well, of course, the truth is that we had an oral agreement for a cap fee with Marshall Miller, not with Bouchard, Margulies, and Freelander. Miller brought them in. My father made it clear, I am doing business with you, Mr. Miller. So Mr. Miller was a necessary party to that litigation. We brought him in. He had to come. He's a lawyer. You know, he's not like us. He's not out buying expensive lawyers. We've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we've spent $3.5 million in trying to resurrect our company, and we have nothing. We got nothing for
it. Your time
is
up. I'm sorry.
Okay. Anyways, that's what I was just saying about the necessary party. I don't understand why he's charging when he's a necessary party and a witness.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I guess in a nutshell, I think Mr. Miller, it should be the poster child for a Rule 11 violation. These are bogus claims.
Oh, put that podium back up.
Well, I've rarely been so attacked. And I could say that out of all the statements made and the numbers and whatnot, almost everything is false, including the part that I brought in an associate, and that was his first case. He was actually a six-year litigation associate. I could go into how I got off the phone with him at 4 o'clock in the morning, rushed up to Delaware on the 7 o'clock train, and had a room of Skadden-Arps lawyers sitting around the conference table trying to reach them on the phone to get an injunction against this. I could go into all of that. But what they're wanting to do is raise for the 20th time these issues of what happened below and how they lost their company. I'll agree with them on one thing. It has nothing to do with our litigation, but I'll agree with them. Their company really got skunked, and that's true. That's really true. Almost everything else you heard is false. But our actions have nothing to do with any claims against Ingersoll Company. You didn't hear any claims about the Ingersoll Company. You didn't hear any claims against the Gaylords as the creditors in the Gaylord action. So if all of this is true as they say, then they should have no objection to your simply dissolving the injunction against the district court action in D.C. and letting us go on and try this breach of contract case in D.C. Thank you very much.
Case is taken under advisement. We'll proceed to the final.